1, 2, 3, 4.
How can physics help solve messy real-world problems? How can we embrace the possibilities of AI while limiting existential risk and abuse by bad actors? Neil Johnson is a physics professor at George Washington University. His research interests lie in the broad area of complex systems and out-of-equilibrium systems of collections of objects, ranging from crowds of particles to crowds of people, and from environments as distinct as quantum information processing and nanostructures to the online world of collective behavior on social media. Neil Johnson, welcome to the Creative Process and One Planet podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into your work at Dawn, the Dynamic Online Networks Lab, tell us a little bit about your upbringing. And I guess some young people growing up wouldn't say, I want to study data science and solve complex real world problems when I grow up. But were you like that?
It's curious because I was always interested, like a lot of people, in, you know, what problems haven't been solved, the kind of messy real world problems. I always remember listening to the news a lot. I'm not sure that was good when I was growing up. You know, you hardly ever hear any of the good news. So I grew up in an era where there was just kind of two sides. It was always very much a discussion about stalemates and the kind of status quo of two objects. Fast forward, I start taking classes in school, of course, and kind of get interested in more math, science-y type things and end up in physics. Although I happened to do an undergraduate degree at Cambridge, which kind of dates back to the days of Newton, but was built around the idea that there's this natural world or the world that we want to understand and that maybe just one discipline isn't enough. And yet I fell into doing a PhD in physics, went to Harvard to do that. That was very straight, kind of you narrow down into one topic, which is great, but I was never really happy with that. I kind of remember that I was interested in problems that were messy. I've done an undergraduate degree, various disciplines mixed together, suggesting that problems need many disciplines to work together. And here I am spending what seemed like 50 years, but was only 5 years, doing a PhD down some really narrow track. Just as I was printing out my PhD, I was thinking to myself, well, that was a waste of time. I know probably more about that tiny little project than anyone else in the world, and who cares? I started reading as I was printing out, because in those days, printers took a long time to print out. It's kind of reading about something called a Santa Fe Institute for Complex Systems, and these things were beginning to become the flavor of the future. You need money when you graduate, you need to do something. So I again fell into kind of postdocs. I became a research fellow in Cambridge for a few years, and then a faculty member in physics at Oxford University, where again, I had to go straight down the line of this is physics, this isn't physics, therefore we don't touch it. But during that process, I started exploring other projects. I've always been interested in the idea that messy problems then might have some kind of solution if you could get data on them. And so now we get into the kind of 2000s, the new millennium, where data is starting to become available. And that was a game changer. That launched me off into looking at all sorts of other disciplines, all sorts of other problems, messy problems, where you could get data.
And it's intriguing to think of people as particles. There's a lot of variance, but draw far enough back, they can be like particles.
You are absolutely right. And that is the main criticism. You know, the classic joke of the physicist, it's like the spherical cow. I want to understand milk production. Okay, all cows are spherical. We've immediately missed off the important things about cows. I think there's a lot of people like me who are like, well, okay, I learned all this physics, but actually I'm more interested in other types of problems than something sitting at minus 273 degrees that I'll never even be able to see. There are lots of people who think about these problems, but the basic and the typical criticism of their work is that they treat objects as identical. So run fast forward to what I'm doing now and have been for quite a few years now is how do you do physics of objects that are not identical? On the one hand, it might sound kind of trivial because it's like, isn't that what particle physicists do? They try to find, yeah, but they're trying to do it one particle at a time. Nobody can explain why the Titanic went down one water molecule at a time, because it was the whole point. There was something emerged out of all of these water molecules in the sea at that time to do with the temperature and all these other things. Some ice had broken off. It still hadn't melted. And it happened to be in the same position as a ship at the time. All of those factors went together, and that none of that explanation comes from a simple assumption of particles being identical in all. So the idea that there's heterogeneity, which is the core idea of all the social sciences, the idea that you could bring that into physics, it's new. You know, proof of that, we had a paper out in Physical Review Letters, which is the top physics journal last year, where they were parading this as, well, you know, nobody's ever done heterogeneous particles and how they act together. And I know now, having suffered through it, why they haven't done it, because it's so hard. All the assumptions physicists make, it's because the particles can be treated as identical. But doing so brings you to conclusions that don't correspond to the messy real world when you look at these other application areas. So we're still in the process of generalizing that.
It's a lot of, I imagine, translation work, translating these figures from your field of physics to political scientists, all these different disciplines that we bring together, from linguists then to the data science. And so I'm wondering how that translation process works, the fine-grained details. How do you work together as a group to map the online multiverse and the various work that you do across platforms?
Yeah, with great patience from both sides. I think that's the absolute, because it's very tricky because we're all in our particular kind of silos. We have our ways of thinking about things. And so for someone to turn up and say, oh, no, don't worry, I've got it all sorted. I've got some data and it shows, that doesn't go down well. So our projects, part of the creative process in some sense, is learning how to interact with other disciplines. It's not something we're trained in, and it's not something that academia in general does. Sometimes the only time that disciplines interact is when they're on some committee together, putting down new curtains or something like this, not to do with the actual work. But that's the creative process. I happen to be a saxophone player, you know, try to be. Actually, these days, I just say I have a saxophone. But you think about something like music, it's not like everyone's a drummer or everyone's a guitarist or everyone's a saxophone player. Part of the richness comes from those different instruments. Their shortcomings and advantages combined together to give the creative. My hope is that's what we end up doing in the academic field to try and address some of these messy problems. But the bottom line is a lot of patience, certainly some data. So instead of having cyclic arguments, you could say, well, in the end, that's what the data is. It doesn't matter what you think might happen. That's what happens. Certainly from our side, listening to the wealth of experience that comes from the other disciplines is, it's so easy then to go straight to the spherical cow. So hard to know what you can assume is irrelevant background noise, like in music. What can I assume is just like the sound of a plane passing over? And what is my cue to start my solo? It's all about what I can assume isn't there and what I can assume is important.
Indeed. And then so I don't know how much intuitive intelligence comes into play, but you're talking about filtering out the noise. And just we should focus in on some of the problems, you know, misinformation and the lack of trust in a post-truth era. And presumably the aim would be to try to put some of these out of equilibrium systems into equilibrium naturally, and, you know, harmonizing when you're a musician.
That's a fantastic comment, because it seems that the physicists are the only ones who haven't got this so far. The world is not in equilibrium and probably will never be. In fact, if you look at creative processes, I'm sure it's true. I'm not an artist in any sense, but, you know, people have, there's a bursty nature to life and to, and therefore the evolution of any system that you're trying to describe, there's a bursty nature. Now, what does that mean? Think of ourselves, you know, we go to sleep. We're not doing much while we're asleep. Then we wake up, then we might have a little bit of activity, and then we may not, and then we have a bit more, and then we go to sleep. So it's an out of equilibrium kind of behavior during the day. And it turns out that in a deep level, when you look at all the data from financial markets, the creation of misinformation, you name it, there's bursty kind of activity in terms of its creativity of new content and promoting what's already there. And that is obvious to anyone outside of physics. It's very hard to describe that mathematically. It's much easier to describe things that are in equilibrium mathematically. So part of our challenge when dealing with things to do with, say, for misinformation, is to try and describe that burstiness in the real world. It's almost like the heartbeat of these systems, because even the heart is not a regular system. What keeps all of our hearts going is a kind of bursty structure around a regular heartbeat. And that's the key to understanding how it operates, how all the little muscles work together. It's trying to create a kind of flexibility. flexibility means strength for systems, say robustness. It's exactly the same, say, in the online world. Some of the most robust networks that create misinformation, generate hate, sustain extremism, have this organic flexibility. And so trying to describe them, that's the challenge.
Yeah, we'll never get that stasis, but we have certain ideals to how, you know, a functioning democracy should work. I understand you're trying to be a safety filter, possibly to help protect society from bad actors and foreign influence. Are we winning?
That's a great question. There are a lot of people who know much more about individual cases looking at this problem. There's no way that my group know all of that. But there is something that we do, others do not do in that space. How could you stop foreign influence? How could you stop misinformation? Most of the discussions, if you look at them, you know, the daily news, are to do with individual cases. There's this particular thing of misinformation, or these particular people were targeted. They are a tiny fraction of the entire population. Imagine one day you wake up and you find water in a pot is boiling. You want to describe it. You want to understand it. Why is water boiling? Imagine we didn't know that. And you go at it one molecule at a time, or two molecules at, well, this molecule is doing this and this molecule. It's all correct, but it's not giving you the big picture. What might you do at scale to stop it happening? And so all of our work, we don't want to just repeat what others are doing. All of our work is looking what happens at scale. What happens at scale is different from what might be happening in individual cases. Often when you read in media reports, et cetera, it sounds a bit chaotic because you hear this case, then you hear this case, and then somebody says it's not as bad as you think, and somebody else says, oh, it's terrible. If you haven't got the big picture, you don't really know what's going on. So our contribution we're trying to make is to map that out, to understand it at scale. And then you can begin to think about solutions at scale, which is something even the platforms struggle with.
Yeah, and it made even more complex at scale because the amount of data that's being collected and stored is now doubling every 2 years. So how do you sift through that daily avalanche of misinformation and actual information on your site, you say, in your lab's words, and how do you find that line between fact and fiction and just plain bullshit?
That is very hard. There is no truth detector, even among AI. What we try to look at is, what is the norm? It's almost like a doctor looking at something like the heart. You know, when you go to a doctor or something, they say, oh, my right arm hurts or something. So what do? They look at the left arm to see what the kind of normal is. And then they see if the right arm is doing something unlike the left arm. So a lot of our work is comparative. Instead of focusing in, is this true or not true? We look in, what's the kind of background behavior? And is there something abnormal happening? Is there a burst of new activity? And then we can zoom in on that and ask, why is that suddenly appearing and it didn't appear before? And then you can zoom in and start looking at, is that true? Is it not true? But you're absolutely right. All the data that's ever been created doesn't disappear. And so you're just adding on the top of it. It's overflowing. So knowing where to look is an extremely hard problem. So we do it based on abnormalities that we detect.
Your work is mostly funded by the U.S. Department of Defense. And one of your current projects is figuring out how or how not to communicate official information during an international crisis. So what specific kind of problems are they most interested in focusing on?
Often people's alarm bells go off when it's the Department of Defense. One has to understand something about the Department of Defense, which I didn't understand before I came to live in the US, is that what they want from academics, their private contractors and within the military is another matter. I have no idea. I have no security clearance or anything. But what they want from the academic field is to create a base of knowledge. They don't want there to be gaps in knowledge. And you can even understand that from a strategic point of view. I mean, if another country knows something and you don't know something, that's not good, because you don't even know what you don't know. So what they're trying to do is maximize the amount of knowledge. And it turns out this area of looking at scale, at threats, particularly in the online world, is so new to them that they don't have that knowledge. And nor does anybody. So they are happy to fund us to look at that, not because they're necessarily going to use it in any way. They want that knowledge to be known to everybody. Because without that, you get fear, you get distrust, And none of that is good for any government. And it's certainly not good for any kind of global stability. People fear things. People distrust things. If we said to draw a picture of the internet, most people go, well, I don't know, really. It's, you know, some dark space. You'd never want that. Imagine you went to a doctor and said, I've got this pain in my ear. And the doctor says, well, inside you is a dark space. Nobody really knows what's going on. You get up and leave. It would create all these misconceptions and fears. So our job is to map it out so that everybody knows what's there. So it removes that kind of element of fear and distrust.
Right. And get back to the sense of a functioning democracy that's always has been a fragile situation, but it seems more so in this last few years. Yes. So tell us about this Shockwaves piece that you've just had published.
We were trying to work out, why is it that it relates to these bursts? Why is it that you have nothing, nothing, nothing for a while, and then just something happens? There's a deep thing going on scientifically. For nothing to happen, and then something to happen, it's either magic, which that is not the case, or there's something going on at some level that you're not understanding. Let me give an example. When you take, and we've probably all done this, you take milk, stick it in the fridge, too lazy to go to the grocery, so you just leave it there, leave it there, leave it. After about 5 days, 10 days, you think, well, it's still okay. And then the 11th day, you go to pour it out and this big glob of curdled, basically the formation has started to form kind of quote unquote cheese. Oh no, the milk's gone bad. Why did that happen on the 11th day? You know, what was it, magic? No. What was happening was that you weren't noticing it. Every day you took it out and all you could see was the macro level. You couldn't see the individual pieces of milk, the polymers. You couldn't see them beginning to aggregate together. What happens is that aggregation goes through this phase transition where there was nothing, 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 and then it appears. Like if you change the temperature of water, nothing, nothing, it's water, 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 or a block of ice. But now it's not happening with temperature, it's happening in time. So this is a new area of physics, the so-called dynamical phase transition. The mathematics of it is, as we showed in our paper, exactly the same as how shock waves appear. So a shockwave is something that I think we can all imagine. I hear nothing, I hear nothing, I hear nothing. A plane's gone over, some supersonic plane. We don't have many of them now. Nothing, bang. What is that bang? It's a wave that's kind of built up so quickly ahead of itself in a way that there's no kind of precursor. You can't see it coming. You can't hear it coming. It just, bang, hits you. Same with, although a tsunami is a different mechanism, a tsunami or a stock market crash. You can't see it coming, usually. That mathematics is the mathematics of shock waves. And we showed that using the data we collect online, these bad behaviors grow organically like that milk in the fridge, day one, day two, day three, day four, day five. And then on the 11th day, bingo, it hits system wide on the internet. But why did this arise? Why did that arise? Why did that? Then get unified in their explanation under this new science. We had to solve this not for spherical cows, identical objects. We had to do it for heterogeneous objects. And it becomes a different kind of mathematics, but the idea is the same. And so now we have a tool for making predictions of when we expect shocks to arise and what shape they'll have. I've actually got on the screen behind me for the October 7th Israel attack is a shock wave. So it raises all these sorts of questions. Was that something that was building up? Did everybody know it was October the 7th? Or was it assembling and it happened to appear on October the 7th, like the milk appearing on the 11th day? So there's all these kind of questions that this then raises that are beyond us to answer. But that's the connection to this new science of shock waves in heterogeneous systems that we tried to address in that paper.
Wow. So would you be able to predict another? I mean, when...
Yeah, of course, prediction in this sense does not mean some date in the future this would happen. What it really does is kind of risk analysis. In fact, we're working with the risk insurance industry now, which is completely separate kind of field again, of looking at the likelihood of some compound disaster happening within the next time frame of a few years, etc. That's the level of prediction, not a specific this will happen on this day. Because that's exactly the type of prediction they need to do. They don't need to do predictions of when a disaster is exactly going to hit. They need to know likelihoods, particularly in an era of climate change. They're all about likelihood of some large compound disaster as opposed to individual things.
You talk about us being walled off in our silos, and in terms of climate change, we often can't see those disasters. But, you know, pulling back to observing animal behavior, they can see it when the tsunami is going to come. I remember, according to an eyewitness in Thailand, a group of elephants broke their chains when they heard the infrasound of an approaching tsunami an hour and a half ahead of it arriving and moved to safety. And there are numerous accounts like this of animals sensing natural hazards through sound waves or vibrations. And birds also know when things are just not right. But I don't know why, but sometimes we're kind of blind to our environment.
It's at a fantastic point that there are precursors. If you know where to look, like you mentioned, the animal, they know what to pick up on as a precursor. That can give you a sense that it's happening. Now, of course, that raises all sorts of science questions that we haven't even addressed yet as to, well, how many times is it successful? How many false positives are there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that's how science progresses, right? You get a kind of handle on something. I think it's like climbing some kind of mountain, although I've never climbed a mountain. But you kind of get a foothold and then you try and get the next one. You don't know where the mountain ends. You've got no idea if you're going to slip. But that's how it progresses.
Can you explain how these bad actor AI-driven systems kind of interact with the broader online ecosystem and how we can distinguish between unintentional misuse of AI technologies and deliberate efforts to create malicious bad actor AI technologies?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. Since I've started looking at all these fields, AI has appeared. It's always been there, but suddenly it appeared on the global scale. It suddenly had a jump in capability. Given that we've been mapping out kind of communities where hate, extremism are promoted, it's a pretty easy guess that they will want to use AI in some way in the future. After all, creating bad content is time intensive. They have to promote it. They have to push it. They create links and they do all these sorts of things. And they have to sleep and eat and all these kind of things. If I can use AI to do that for me, I'll use it. Now we've got this kind of roadmap of where these communities are, how they're connected, and they are literally now connected one step away from the rest of us. I can get to that in a minute. What we wanted to look at is, well, what AI will they use? Where will they use it? When will they use it? And what can we do about it? And that was a recent paper we had out in PNAS, Nexus, which provided an answer to those questions. So the first thing of what AI? Well, we hear a lot about what the latest AI can do. It's remarkable what it can do. But they don't need that. They just need something simple. When you look on social media, you're not seeing Shakespeare-level text. It is pretty basic, errorful, bad grammar stuff. And basic AI is really good at producing that. One of the things we found in our paper was that something like GPT-2, we always hear about GPT-4 and GPT-5, which is going to come out very soon. GPT-2 can run on a laptop. In fact, you can probably get it on a phone now, and it can produce content 24/7. And we showed in our paper that it can produce content that is, to a human, even an expert, indistinguishable from the human-created content that is already there, the human-created hate, conspiracy, distrust, etc. content, the bad actor content. And so that's a natural tool for them to use. It's probably already being used. In fact, we already know that there are websites that sell things like GPT-2 that has been trained on hate and extremism content. So it's almost like a ready-made tool for them to create content. Second, where will it go? When COVID hit, there was a lot of racist content, particularly against the Asian community. Where did it go? It went on exactly the same networks that had previously been used for right-wing extremism, hate, and this kind of thing. It's almost like the existing roadways are exactly what they need. So that's where it will be. The when it will be, we looked at, again, you've got to pick things from different fields and claw your way up the mountain. So the when will this occur? We looked at something called progress curves, which are the acceleration of technology. And we look back in time as how people had used cyber attacks, how they'd progressed with the algorithm writing, how quickly they produced improvements. And we applied it to the current progress of GPT technology. And we found that pretty much this summer is like the time for fruition for being able to produce GPT running continually within each of these hate and extremism communities globally. Time will tell whether that prediction it actually comes to be true. But that's what our analysis predicted mathematically. And then the final thing of what can be done about it. Well, if you know the structure, you know where something is, you've got a much better chance of being able to do something about it. And we had a paper out just a couple of days ago that we did with a group in international relations here at George Washington University that looked at inviting people online anonymously into groups. And instead of just taking people at the two ends of the extreme, which when you put them together, pretty explosive, or they just end up not talking to each other, you also put in the ones in the middle who are kind of on the fence, that haven't really expressed an opinion one way or the other. And it turns out, at least in these pilot experiments, when you put the three sets, it's almost like two's company, three's a crowd, you put the three in, it softens over time, on average, it slightly softens the extremes. They ask them questions before and they ask them questions after, and they rank the questions in terms of extreme views on a scale, and they do all these kind of things. So we produced this paper with them whereby we took their results and we modeled using a computer simulation what that would look like if we scaled it up to all the platforms globally. And you can see a softening of the extreme views online at scale if this were to be implemented across platforms. Now, will the platforms adopt this? That then becomes a question beyond my knowledge, but I hope that they do, because the data shows that this should work, and nothing has worked really so far. Hate and extremism are still there. Extreme views are still there. Now, why is that important in an AI age? Well, if the AI is being produced 24/7, you need something that's automated and at scale. And so this scheme is the only one I know that can be automated at scale across platforms running 24/7 to counteract that bad actor AI.
Yeah, and I've noticed in your research of online extremist groups, you've sort of drawn parallels between their behavior and that of natural systems such as fish schools. But could you elaborate more on this and like help us understand why you use this systems level approach to look at extremism?
So the reason we went for a systems level view is because I always go back to this thing of you can't understand water boiling one molecule at a time. You can't understand why milk produces that curd on the 11th day, one molecule of milk at a time. You need a systems view. And so there are plenty of people working on looking at online extremism, etc., but very few looking at the system level. So that's why we went for the system level. Now, to do that, you need data and you need some kind of idea to compare it to. Again, the idea of climbing up the mountain without really knowing where I'm going. I'm not an expert in animal societies and animal behavior, but we've all seen National Geographic pictures of animals, fish, etc., forming into groups, and then when a predator comes, scattering. And it turns out when we looked at the data, that's exactly what the online communities that promote hate and extremism do. They form into their communities, the communities connect to each other, but when moderators come or there's some kind of threat, they scatter. They break the links, they break the community, and so they get this kind of shattering. So you get what an anthropologist would call fusion of objects into some group, and then sudden what they would call fission. Now, it turns out that fusion fission behavior is the central idea in anthropology of how societies develop, tribes and then break and et cetera when under threat. And so this idea became the key to understanding how extremism operates at scale online. It doesn't matter what the extremism is, it's a collective human behavior. ISIS didn't exist before 2014. Who knows what the next threat will be, who it will be from, what their agenda will be. But what we do know is that their behavior will involve a fusion and then sudden fission. And this will go on and on. And this is what underlies these kind of shockwaves that become a threat. The internet, like the real world, will always have threats at some low level, but that's probably manageable for society. What we all want to worry about is when something suddenly appears out of nowhere at the large scale. And so that's what our work contributes to understanding.
Yes, all these things that are developing slowly or subterranean in the dark and we don't know, and it's accumulating, as you're saying. You spoke about how AI can be used to accelerate and propagate the labor of writing hate speech. Bill Gates said that AI will change jobs for everyone except those who create AI. So with the loss or the change of many traditional jobs, people not finding as much purpose and meaning in their life because their jobs are under threat, this sense of like insecurity and needing to find communities online, maybe extremist groups.
I'm a huge optimist for AI, actually. Of course, it could be used in a bad way that I was just talking about, but so can a car. And I'm a fan of a car when I need to go on holiday or something like this. AI, although it will probably change the workplace in dramatic ways that even Bill Gates probably can't imagine, I see it as part of that process of climbing up, society climbing up its own mountain. It's a tool and it could do wonders for so many areas of science, medicine. You know, I was spent the weekend looking at how good AI is to create jazz because I like jazz, and it took me a lot of money to even learn what I don't know about jazz. A lot of money in classes and buying books and all these kind of things. So I was thinking, can AI produce jazz? And the answer is, yeah, it can. In fact, it can produce really good jazz. And so that's a threat to musicians. However, on the other hand, it's also a creative tool. It can write the next Taylor Swift song or something like this. I don't think so. But what it will be useful for is helping to create that. And so I see that AI is very much as a tool. The worst thing is to ignore it individually. We can't ignore it. We should all learn something about it because it might be useful for us. When the car came out, I think the ones that lost were the ones that just kept their horses. In the end, you can keep your horse and ignore the car because the car initially is a disaster and it breaks down and it can't go very fast. But you fast forward and it was the key to so many advances in society. So I think it's exactly the same as AI. We are actually spending a lot of time talking about this assembly, a little bit of a parallel topic. But the big challenge of AI is not really to create better AI. That will come. Big challenge is to understand why it works. And you hear so many things now that part of the fear of it is that it's a black box and nobody knows how it works. And therefore, nobody can ever know how it works. But we're actually doing a project based on some recent work of the Google DeepMind group that are trying to build the simplest possible version of AI and deconstruct it to see how it works. And they found evidence of the same kind of shockwave behavior that we've seen in our mathematics is what drives AI. You know, AI existed for years. I remember even graduate school, people would talk about AI, but it was useless in the sense that it didn't do anything interesting, certainly not at the level of society. And so it's not that AI grew in some linear way. It went on, nothing useful, nothing useful, nothing useful. And then maybe, when was it? Like last year or something? Oh, now it's really useful. Look at all these things. There's DALL-E, you can create photos. Why? Because there seemed to be some kind of jump in its ability, almost like a shockwave. Fast forward to what we're trying to do now. It seems that is how this is totally speculative. We have not published on this. We are still looking at this. This is what I'm doing. When I get off this chat with you, that's what I'll be going back to doing, because we're trying to develop an understanding of how AI operates in terms of these shockwave kind of jumps. And imagine we're successful, or someone else will be who's much smarter than me. That could remove all the fear. Because if you know how it's working, you don't really need to be fearful. You can look at a toolkit. You don't know what it could produce, because that needs the creativity of the person who has the toolkit. But at least you've got an idea of what it can and can't do. And we think that by revealing how AI works, that will help society understand what it can and can't do, and therefore remove some of this dark fear of being taken over and all this kind of thing.
I just believe that there should be governance in every sector, governance and guardrails. So you wrote Simply Complexity, A Clear Guide to Understanding Complexity Theory. If you were to update it today.
First chapter will probably be AI completely, yeah. And I completely agree about the governance. But if you don't understand how AI works, how can you govern it? It's the same question as with the online world. All these things about governing the platforms, you always get the same three people in front of Congress. The EU law only deals with the large platforms because they're the only ones that they can see and control. If you don't know what is actually there, which is actually the truth in the case of platforms, is there's a whole sea of small platforms that provide the glue that keep them together. In the case of AI, there's something else that we're trying to understand. If you don't know those pieces, how can you govern them? You're going to end up with rules that are vague, can't be implemented, and probably miss the point. We've seen that with what Congress is trying to do and what the EU has done with the Digital Services Act. It misses the point because it just goes to the large platforms. The same with AI. To get effective governance, to help democracies, you need to understand how AI works, because otherwise you don't know what you're going to regulate. You end up kind of just saying, well, there shouldn't be any AI. Or you say, as the EU and Congress are trying to do, oh, well, you should show us everything that's in the AI. We've all sure that everyone's seen AI. It's just a whole bunch of code. So I could show you the code, could even draw a diagram, but it doesn't tell you how it works. It's like when I know Eustace at fixing cars, but the modern cars, I used to be able to do my old car, but I can't do the modern. You lift up the hood, you take a look at it. Everything is there, but you got no idea how it works because it's all kind of computer driven in there, but all the pieces are there. That's the danger of the governance. In the end, it will be the large companies delivering the program, ChatGPT-9, and GPT-9 will fit on a thumb drive or something, and it will be delivered to Congress or delivered to the EU. What are they going to do with it? Are you going to have somebody look at it? If you look at it, even my own programs, when I look at them 3 months later, I can't work out how they work. And so AI, which is learning from this huge base of information and then running forward, impossible to tell how it's working and therefore what the dangers are. So I completely agree about governance, but how are you going to do it if you don't know how it works?
It makes sense, but it makes me feel like once you understand this very simple AI, you know, ChatGPT-3, but, you know, then we're at ChatGPT-12, it'll be so far ahead.
But they all build on the same principle. You know, they all have an encoder, which basically takes all the tokens in the learning data and turns them into directions in some space, and then it compresses those down to some reduced dimension. It looks, and then when somebody prompts the machine, all it does is expand that out and spit out an answer. I mean, that's kind of like in 20 seconds, but of course, how does it do all that? But that's basically how it works. And they all work that way. So although they're called different names, and there's a, you know, they're unbelievable array of names and companies doing this, and it's all different, and everything seems to, it all works in that way. So if we understand that principle properly, just like all liquids work in the same way, well, they do and they don't, but the principles are the same. Up comes somebody with ChatGPT 27. But since you know how it's built, you can say, well, it's that much more of a problem than the previous version, or it's that much more. In fact, it's no different. But without that, you can't. It just sounds terrible.
Yes. And with all those possibilities for creativity and labor saving, the disbalance. I'm wondering for you, with so much of your work focused on sifting through the disinformation and the bad actors, how do you avoid burnout and cynicism, you know, maintain your belief in the resilience of democracy, institutions and journalism for upholding the truth?
I'm a massive optimist because I think it's always been like this. I grew up in an era when I thought the world was going to end, jumping under the desks at school to practice. So all of this has always been there. It's just never been at scale in some ethereal way that we can't picture now. You know, it used to be the two-body problem and therefore the us and the them. And now there's a them, a them, a them, a them. But that's still the same principle. You map it out. You try to understand where it is. And then you can look at the risk and think about it. It's the same with the body. You know, the more we know about the body, the more complicated it looks. But by mapping out the pieces, you're heading towards a better understanding. Medicine now is streets ahead from what it was 20 years ago. In the same way, mapping things out is the answer. And I don't think people have got worse over time. Human nature is pretty much probably the same. And so it's just the vehicles they use seem a little bit more obscure and therefore threatening. But so are the tools to try and resolve it. So yeah, I'm an optimist.
My name is Nadia and I'm a student studying in Northwestern University's Specialized Media Campus in Qatar. For me, AI is really this double-edged sword. As a research assistant, I've helped my professor identify case examples of AI in the field of media. And even though I always have acknowledged how impressive AI is, like for example, OpenAI's recent text-to-video model Sora, I've always also been kind of concerned about the impacts, especially to marginalized groups, if it's released to the public without any proper regulations. But as I listen to Neil Johnson's conversation and his stance on AI, I think I understand that, sure, AI is far from neutral, especially now, and it'll take a long time to adapt, definitely, to ensure it is used ethically without any bad actor AI technologies. But it's like Neil Johnson's metaphor, a mountain of progress we slowly climb. Emphasis on the slowly. And I think you can apply this to everything else. There's always going to be threats in society. There's always going to be these complex problems. But I think we often forget about the progress that has already been made. Neil Johnson reflected on his childhood and how he grew up in a world full of the us and them rhetoric. Now, it still seems like there's a lot of uncertainty in our world. Just turning on the news is enough to make us feel as if the world is unstable and we're on the verge of crisis after crisis. I know I'm definitely guilty doing that. But we shouldn't forget that our world is a lot more united. We've made so much more progress in securing basic human rights, and these ideas of climate change and sustainability are finally acknowledged by most people, as opposed to in the past when people didn't even think about the environment at all. And perhaps that's why it feels so fragile right now, because we're still really in this beginning stage of all this globalization and environmental activism. But like the complexity theory Neil Johnson tells us about, there's a pattern to everything, like the milk in the fridge. If we were to break it down in terms of particles and waves, Neil Johnson makes it clear in his research that collective behavior can be predicted. So even though there's so much mistrust, I think as long as we take our time to understand the trends, to continue playing our role in creating a drive and striving for change, there's optimism that our planet can heal and that our future generations can live in a peaceful world. When Neil Johnson mentioned how interdisciplinary his current work is, I thought back to how back in high school I also noticed this trend where more than half of the class doing higher level physics were also doing higher level philosophy. For me, physics is more than just calculations and math. There's really an inherent linkage between physics and questioning the bigger picture beyond what is available only in the lab. It's so inspirational to see a physicist like Neil Johnson utilize his skills beyond traditional theoretical physics to apply it to these complex problems that are so relevant in our post-stress world. And for him to still maintain this much optimism despite knowing so much information, I think we should also give it a shot. Now back to the interview.
And many people nowadays, we're all interested in the application of technology and science to sustainability efforts. But how do you think AI and perhaps your research in complex theory can help us understand and address environmental challenges to promote a greener world?
I think this goes back to, it even transcends sustainability, because the question is, would you trust something that comes out of AI that had to do with sustainability? Imagine there was the best possible piece of AI, and we fed everything into it, and the sustainability is that we should all go and live in Canada. Great. Okay, fine. Do we trust that? We would need to understand why AI came out with that answer. I think AI has these answers in it. I absolutely do. Maybe not in this current version, but in the future, it will have great answers that we have never thought of. And I bet you some of them will be the answer that we need in practice. There's never a best answer, but better is probably good compared with some of the other things that have been thrown around. But I don't think people are going to trust it unless they understand how the system came to that answer. It gets back to this core question. I'm so excited. I just wish I was a young scientist going into this. Why AI comes out with what it does? That's the burning question. It's bigger than the origin of the universe to me as a scientist. So it's quite an exciting moment. And I do think it has those answers to those questions that you mentioned. Yeah.
That's quite a big thing to say that it's bigger than the origins of the universe as a question. Some people say it can have sentience or may develop sentience. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it might do. How amazing that would be. I'm a physicist. It's saying that I think that's more important than the origin of the universe. So you're absolutely right. That's a big claim. That's my own opinion. And here's the reason why. The origin of the universe, it happened. It definitely happened. That's why we're here. It's almost like a historical question asking why it happened or might happen again. Well, I don't know about that. You know, it happened and that's a historical question. The AI future is not a historical question. It's a now and future question. So that's why I made that claim.
Yeah, exactly. It's how we can apply it to our lives. So on these basic things about how we can apply it to our lives, I mean, what are your reflections on the future of education and how we can adapt our education models and prepare young people for the future of work?
It's absolutely clear to me. It has to be embraced straight into education from the elementary level up. AI should be incorporated, should be a tool that people can use. I'm a professor. I have to give classes, exams. My tiny little experience talking with other faculty is there's a big fear, not because AI is bad for learning, but because it complicates giving exams and therefore grades, because you don't know if it was done by AI. Yeah, I get that. Okay, so rethink how you do examining, how you do grades. The big disservice to future generations of my generation, apart from throwing out plastic bags and plastic cups and all that kind of thing that unfortunately we've been doing for years, the big disservice to them would be to not incorporate this immediately into their education from the ground up.
No, of course, it is being done. And I think it's just how it can be implemented without negating those as a possible new life form, which some people are calling it as a new silicon life form, you know, effectively, in some sense, I guess it is metaphorically. We talked a little bit about your curiosity growing up, but if you could just reflect on your upbringing, your parents, those teachers who have been important to you, the mentors along the way.
Yeah, I was my first generation going to college. So I didn't really know what education was all about, actually. I've had some very inspirational teachers and some very non-inspirational teachers, like everybody, I think. But there was one that stands out by miles, and that was a teacher I had in elementary school when I was 8. He was from Jamaica. He just arrived in England, got this job to teach 8-year-olds. I'm not sure that he'd actually taught before, thinking back, because it turns out he was a jazz musician. This is how my start of being a jazz musician started with him. Because in the mornings, you know, sometimes I can't remember any of elementary school, but I do remember being in his class and he would start off the day playing jazz. And he had a piano in there, I mean, some terrible out-of-tune piano. But anyway, he was playing this music and I've never heard this kind of thing. He was just completely inspirational because it turns out that, you know, I didn't go to a great school. It wasn't necessarily a great area of England. So he was also charged with teaching the math. So suddenly there's someone who probably wasn't a teacher and he's really just a pianist and he's teaching math as well. But he brought in some technique, which I still use to this day to multiply numbers together. And I've never seen it taught anywhere, which is to turn multiplication rather than writing out long multiplication and carrying over. It was done in some kind of slanted table. I could show an example, but anyway, to me, this was like, oh yeah, I'd heard about multiplication because we'd done it the previous year and I couldn't understand it. He drew these tables and this just inspired me. I thought this was just remarkable. That with the music, my favorite year, my only great year in school, that was the whole of career that set me off. And it showed me, what did I learn from that? That's what I learned, that there was this interesting thing called jazz. But the second thing I learned was that you don't have to do much to actually change a lot. And so passing on some idea that might be unusual, as long as you can back it up, can have a really positive benefit going forward for future generations. So that's what I try to do. So that was my most inspiration by far. In fact, all the others are almost like at the start line compared with that. And I'm including university as well.
That's amazing. He just gave that seed and the creativity that it would allow you that permission to do hard things. And I would say maybe it was also the beginning of these interdisciplinary dialogues that you're having.
Probably is.
But as you think about the future in education, what would you like young people to know, preserve and remember?
I'm so happy for them because I think the era of having to memorize things, you know, exams based on remembering 30 pages of a book or something like that are going to go by the wayside. And so I think education is actually going to come back on a mass level, what was the privilege of a few kind of privileged people centuries ago, which was to just kind of almost like close your eyes and think rather than, oh, I've got to remember this date and this number or this multiplication table or this remember. I think that's gone away. And so I think we're going to turn into a very creative period where education, even at the elementary high school level, becomes creative rather than jumping through the hoops and remembering things. So I'm really excited for anybody who's entering their education. If you're 3 years old, good for you. You've got it all ahead of you. A great, great future in education that none of us actually had necessarily.
Yeah, indeed. Heralding a new era where we can all begin to riff on ideas, even though they're outside of our discipline. And I think that's what you've done. This has been a very inspiring conversation for us. So Thank you, Neil Johnson, for sharing your excitement in the music of intellectual pursuit and your general curiosity, just helping us identify equilibrium and all the complexity and mapping out the pieces so we can better understand systems and society. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Yam Ishasky Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Nadia Lam with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer and associate text editor on this episode was Nadia Lam. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier and Sam Myers. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.